David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. The number of Americans who get a monthly disability check from the federal government is up to 14 million people. And that number has gone way up in the last 30 years. In some counties, one in four adults is on disability, and they're not counted in the unemployment figures we look at each month. They're considered not part of the labor force at all. So that's 14 million people on top of the 12 million people who are unemployed. The show This American Life dedicated the latest episode to this story. And joining us now is the reporter who told that story, Hanna Jaffe-Walt. Hanna, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Hi.
So first of all, what does it mean to be disabled according to the federal government?
So the disability programs, there's two big federal disability programs, and they're run by the Social Security Administration. And in both programs, you have to prove to the Social Security that you're so disabled that you cannot work. And that is done through a variety of ways. Mostly the biggest way goes to medical records. So you go to the doctor and the doctor examines you and says that you are unable to work. And then the Social Security Administration decides whether or not you qualify.
So who's on disability? I mean, are these baby boomers or?
So a big part of the growth story is an aging workforce. You know, the largest group on disability is always sort of in their 50s. And as more and more baby boomers move through that age bracket, you see some growth because of that. And then the bigger story that I was interested in is just there's all this other growth that seems to be, you know, part of the story that doesn't get explained by the baby boomers, that I wanted to figure out, that seemed like it had something to do more with what was going on in our larger economy, and that these programs are sort of standing in as a social safety net in a way that they were never really designed to do.
And disability used to mean something different, or at least the people on disability used to qualify for different reasons.
Right, right. So in the disability program for workers was created in 1956. And at that time, you know, there was a lot of debate about who was disabled. The disability is not a diagnosis. So it's, you know, the government has to define what it means. And at the time, primarily people who were on disability had very severe illnesses. Many of those illnesses led to death in a short amount of time.
Heart disease, and stuff like that.
Right, exactly, and cancers. And in 1984, Congress changed the definition of disability to include more broadly mental illnesses and to include musculoskeletal disorders, which for the most part means back pain, and things that are pain, basically mental illnesses and pain-related illnesses that can be very severe but are also harder to measure. And that change really created this whole other world in disability and created an opening for lawyers to come and help people appeal and make their arguments. And there was much more gray area of who qualified and who didn't.
Yeah. Over 30% for back pain, 20% for mental illness. What's that about? Is there more back pain now?
Right. So right now, people in those two categories account for most of the people who are coming onto the disability rolls. And I would say that part of what seems to be happening, especially in places, you know, where one in four working age people are on disability or the numbers are very high, is that basically just the local economy has changed. So the story that we often hear about, you know, a local industry leaving, offshoring of jobs, manufacturing leaving, those people that have been left behind, we don't often sort of hear the second part of the story. But I think in a lot of those places, what has happened is people have turned to this program, which is kind of the best option in that situation. And they have real issues. They've had hard jobs that are often very physical. And the pain is real. But it's also a program that exists in as an option against a minimum wage job, which, you know, you make not that much more than you'd make on disability. And it's a job that you may or may not be able to keep and often doesn't come with health insurance. And disability benefits comes with Medicare for workers.
Right. So you spent months in Hale County, Alabama, where one in four adults, you say, is on disability. It really shapes life there. And there's basically one doctor who's vouching for the medical conditions of these disabled people. When you interviewed him, he told you that he always asks his patients' education level and factors that into when he's considering if they're disabled. Let's take a listen to a clip here from Dr. Timberlake.
I mean, on the exam, I say what I see and what turned out, and then I say they're completely disabled to do gainful work, gainful way you earn money, now or in the future. Now, could they eventually get a sit-down job? Is that possible? Yeah, but it's very, very unlikely.
So basically he's saying that these people are disabled in the context of our economy? Is that what disability is supposed to be for?
Right. I mean, Dr. Timberlake would say they are disabled in that they have real, but mostly back issues in Alabama, and particularly in that area, there's a lot of back issues. But also that it matters what their education level is, which is something that you don't often think about, you know, when you think about you're disabled or you're not. It doesn't have to do with your particular place in the economy or your skills or your education. And Dr. Timberlake is basically saying it has a huge effect on whether or not you can work. If the question is, can this person work, it matters if they have a high school degree or a college degree, especially if they live in a place where those are the kind of jobs that are available. You know, most of the economy, more education that you have means the better options you have. And so he takes that into account. And sort of the more time I spent there, the more that actually made sense, you know, that there's a whole, like, the majority of people that I met on disability had not kind of, were not even really aware of this new economy where you get to have jobs that can accommodate back pain.
Right.
And jobs that can accommodate a variety of disabilities. Those were not the options in front of them. And so it did seem to really matter what people's skills and education level was.
Yeah, here's a woman on disability who you interviewed. You were trying to ask people about whether they could imagine going back to work. You asked her about what her dream job would be. After thinking about it a little bit, she said this.
The perfect job would be, it would be like I would sit at a desk like that. Social Security people, and just weed out all the ones that come in and file for disability.
So that's a very specific and also very ordinary job to describe as your dream job.
Right.
But you got to the bottom of why that was her perfect job, right?
Yeah, so this is Ethel Thomas, and she worked in a fish plant in Hale County, and then she worked as a healthcare aide. And I thought when she mentioned that she wanted to be the Social Security lady who accepts or denies people because she thought she'd be good at accepting or denying people, or she thought that there were lots of people who were cheating, and that was not the case. You know, the more that we talked, it turned out that the reason she mentioned this particular woman is because she had a job where she got to sit. Mm. And I sort of said, okay, but what about all the other jobs where you get to sit? Like, why that job? And she said she had not seen another job where you get to sit all day. She couldn't imagine a job where you get to sit all day, which I did not buy at first, or I sort of brushed it off when we were talking. But throughout my time there later, I thought that actually really may be true, given the industries that are there, given the job listings that I saw while I was in Greensboro in her town. There really aren't jobs that can accommodate a disability like that.
Hmm. You report that the number of kids on disability is 7 times larger than it was 30 years ago. They can pull a check. Explain what has become this perverse incentive for parents. If the kids start doing better in school or gets medical help he needs, he'll no longer qualify for a disability check, and the parents are reliant on that.
Yeah, so this is through a program called Supplemental Security Income, which is the government disability program for poor people. And it, unlike the other program, in this program you can qualify if you're a child, and then the child's family gets a check for that child's disability. And part of the growth has to do with a change also in the definition of what it means to be disabled as a child. As an adult, you know, you look at whether somebody can work and perform in the workplace. As a kid, it became part of the definition that you would look at how the kid is doing in school, among many other factors. But given if the kid had a learning disability or ADHD or a behavioral issue, then, you know, it would be important to look at their progress in school, what their teacher said about them. And that now is the majority of kids on the SSI program are on for diagnoses like that, where it matters how you're doing in school. So because it's a program that is for poor families and because they look at progress in school, it's set up in this way that it matters, you know, that the family income, or oftentimes a large part of the family income, relies on how the kid is doing in school and depends on that kid's disability. And kids get reviewed, you know, every few years to see if they're still disabled. And if they're not seen as disabled, which in many cases can mean that they're doing great in school and have been able to accommodate their disability or overcome their disability, then that can be bad for the family income, which is not the way you want those incentives to be set up.
Yeah. There's been some pushback to your piece that you suggest that disability payments encourage families not to work when, in fact, disability benefits supposed to incentivize work, and that you suggest that the current system doesn't really help kids with disabilities, but that, in fact, it significantly reduces poverty for kids with disabilities. This American Life says they stick by your story absolutely. What do you have to say to those?
Right. Those are not claims that we make in the piece at all. I mean, it's obvious that the program helps families who are in poverty because the program is a check-writing program. They give money to families in poverty. And for a lot of families in poverty, it's a really large part of their income. So it certainly helps people have more money. What we wanted to look at is just, you know, if you were to design a program for kids with disabilities, which a lot of people would probably argue that we should have a program like that, what are the incentives that you want to be in that program? And tying an income to a kid's disability is probably not the way that you would want to set that program up.
All right. I thought, interestingly, the part that this has become a business for some, getting people onto disability. You call it the disability industrial complex. Let me play a little mashup of advertisements for disability lawyers.
If you've been denied your Social Security disability benefit,
has your disability claim been denied?
If you've applied for Social Security disability benefits
and the government says no,
don't give up.
You can receive disability benefits for conditions such as cancer, depression, spinal injury, diabetes, and more.
You don't have to be an invalid. You don't have to be out on a stretcher.
Tell the government you mean business.
Call Attorney Ed Tand.
Put our team to work.
We'll deal with the government. You have enough to worry about.
Don't give up. There's a whole cottage industry built up around disability. Why is that? Is the process so complex that you need a lawyer to navigate it?
I mean, it can be very difficult to figure out the process for applying, and especially for somebody who has a disability, it can be difficult to work your way through that system. A third of the people get denied when they first apply. Most people don't apply with representation the first time, but many of those people then go on to appeal their decisions, and many of them choose to work with a lawyer who sort of knows exactly what documentation a judge is going to want to see and exactly how to make the argument about their disability. And I think what's part of what has spawned this industry is these diagnoses that are harder, that where there's not, you know, sort of clear lines, where you can make an argument about some of us who have back pain, we can work, and some of us who can't. So a lawyer is there to sort of help you make the argument about why you are a person who can't. Part of what's bizarre about the way the system is set up, which I didn't know, is lawyers go, you know, come with their client to represent their client before an administrative law judge who's an employee of Social Security. And they make the argument for the client about why this person's depression or back pain or other illness is making it so that they cannot work. There's nobody on the other side that's arguing for the government, that's saying, here's why we denied this person initially, and here's why, you know, I'm here to protect the public interest, and I'm going to make an argument about why this person should not be on the program. And judges that I talked to who work in this position said that's actually really difficult for them because they, you know, they have this sort of persuasive lawyer who's there representing one side, and they often have questions that they want to run by the government to say, you know, why did you make this initial decision? And right. There's nobody there to do that.
All right. Hani Jaffe Walt is with Planet Money. Her piece on the disability boom airs on This American Life this week. Hannah, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Up next, when should you start feeding your baby solid food? David Cruz in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay tuned.